move to the second case of the day, United States versus the Flukers, 11-1013, which have been consolidated. Ronanita first, Mr. Fisk. Is that the order I understood?
That is, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Fisk, and I'm before you to represent the defendant, Ronanita Fluker. Ms. Fluker's conviction should be reversed, and her case should be remanded for a new trial, because the trial court abused its discretion by providing the jury with an ostrich instruction that was not warranted by the evidence and that invited the jury to conclude that Ms. Fluker was guilty because she was unreasonable or negligent, rather than because she had actual knowledge of criminal activity. The ostrich instruction cannot be used to substitute a reasonableness standard for actual knowledge, nor can it be used to provide the jury with a means to find liability based on negligent or reckless conduct when a showing of actual knowledge is required. Here, as in United States versus Cavanetti, the use of the ostrich instruction confused the jury's inquiry rather than advancing it. By pointing the jury to circumstances of deliberate avoidance of knowledge, when the government's presentation of evidence actually sought to demonstrate actual knowledge rather than deliberate avoidance. A defendant can deliberately avoid learning of criminal activity by physical means, such as physically removing oneself from the situation, or by psychological means, which represent a much softer concept that requires delicacy in order to interpret and impose. And for that reason, the ostrich instruction is designed to be used with great caution. In this case, the evidence demonstrated that Ms. Fluker acted to preserve all of the records of the housing program at issue, when her self-interest clearly would have dictated that those records be lost or destroyed. Similarly, Ms. Fluker's father controlled all information about the investments that were the purported heart of these programs, and there was no evidence that Ms. Fluker either had access to this key information about how the programs were funded and made possible, or had the opportunity to obtain such knowledge and refused. The use of the ostrich instruction was not appropriate here and served only to allow the jury to substitute a lesser standard of negligence or reasonableness for the required standard of actual knowledge. In circumstances where the ostrich instruction is allowed to be interposed, where actual knowledge is allowed to be demonstrated by deliberate avoidance of knowledge in the record, the cases show that the level of evidence in the record necessary to show deliberate avoidance demonstrates largely that the evidentiary record is replete with different circumstances showing that a defendant deliberately avoided such knowledge.
Do you think this instruction overrode what would otherwise be a very reasonable opportunity to show that she was fully involved and knew knowledge of the whole operation, both sides of it?
I believe what the use of the instruction did is that it improperly confused the issue in that it took what would have been what's termed in the cases as a binary choice between she either had actual knowledge or had no knowledge whatsoever, and allowed the jury to interpose its own estimation of what a reasonable person perhaps should have known about this scheme. The evidence did not show that the program as it operated was particularly sophisticated, and it was quite easy to frame it in such a manner as to suggest that any reasonable person looking at this information would think that there was something wrong. The difficulty, however, which the ostrich instruction allowed, is that the assessment of reasonableness is not something the jury is permitted to look at in the case such as here, where actual knowledge is required. And so while the government would have been able to present evidence, as it states in its brief, of both actual knowledge and deliberate avoidance of knowledge, Really, what the factual record shows is that the government was portraying that Ms. Fluker had actual knowledge of what was happening, which is obviously permitted. But when the ostrich instruction is interposed, that creates a problem because that allows the jury, rather than determining whether enough actual knowledge existed to convict Ms. Fluker, to instead take on what is an improper estimation of reasonableness, or to look at her and say, well, she was simply negligent. She simply operated from a mental state that was either careless or reckless or for whatever reason did not learn for those reasons. And it is that circumstance, particularly because, as is seen from the government's brief talks a lot about Mr. Fluker Jr., the father. And it is quite clear from the evidentiary record that this was Mr. Fluker Jr.'s program. He developed it, he controlled crucial information about it that he gave to no one else, and the government's presentation created a situation where Ms. Fluker was portrayed within the penumbra of that. Again, demonstrating actual knowledge in that circumstance is fine. It is the interposition of the ostrich instruction, which allowed the jury to assess whether her knowledge, lack of knowledge was reasonable, that created the ability for the jury not to apply the actual standard and merits reversal and remand.
But don't some of our cases indicate that if there's enough actual knowledge, the giving of the ostrich instruction can be harmless?
Yes.
How do you deal with those?
My feeling is that given the cases that demonstrate, I do not feel that the actual knowledge demonstrated here was sufficient to demonstrate this as harmless error. I believe that what the government's approach...
He's right there at the presentation meetings where he's saying you'll get 25% back per month for 12 months in these pretty amazing statements, and she's involved in the computer aspect of the operation and so forth. That's pretty heavy involvement.
I would certainly, of course, acknowledge that the record certainly can show that there was actual knowledge on her part. I think the question of whether it becomes harmless error is whether that accumulated information is sufficient to overcome the damage caused by the ostrich instruction. My suggestion would be, particularly with the aspect of the computer operations that you mentioned, Judge Kaur, in giving the instruction, made specific references to her computer knowledge. And I acknowledge that I'm taking my rebuttal time, but I would prefer to do that now rather than reserve it. Judge Kaur acknowledged that her use of a computer very much went into his estimation about whether the ostrich instruction was appropriate. Now, the use of a computer does not necessarily mean that you have access to information that is on that computer. It may not mean...
Destroying my faith in computers.
I think any faith in computers can be easily misplaced. And in her specific situation, where the government tries to imply, and I see my red light is on, if I might just continue this thought.
Finish this thought, yes.
Thank you. The mere fact that one can use a computer does not mean, for example, that there was a file on that computer screen that said shady investments, and that if she clicked on it, she would know all of this information. It tells you nothing about her deliberately avoiding information. It tells you only that she operated a computer for certain things, and that does not rise to the level of actual knowledge, nor does it demonstrate deliberate avoidance of such knowledge.
I would like to just ask one question, and that is, she did get acquitted on some things, right?
She did. She was found not liable on 3 of the 11 counts against
her. I'm just wondering, you know, that those are closer questions. I don't know nothing about it, but as far as focusing on the trial itself, there may have been some issues there where deliberate indifference or the ostrich, whatever you want to do, deliberate avoidance, I mean, would have been important in those particular ones, and she may have won on that basis that she really didn't know, and that wasn't deliberate avoidance. And I'm just wondering if this segments some of her accusations or what was charged, because she did get off the hook on three things.
If I may reply again, knowing that my time is up, I'd be happy to reply briefly. Just to say that I concur that it's difficult to tell from the record whether the deliberate avoidance issue came into play on the counts for which she was acquitted. And the fact that we don't know is really essentially the problem. And while it may have gone to her favor in those cases, we don't know to what extent the jury took into account the ostrich instruction in those where she was found liable. And it is that failure to have guidance about what the jury considered and why that should have precluded the use of the instruction in this case.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Beal for Roy III. Go by nickname, or how do they just,
excuse me?
Do they go by nicknames, Roy the Third?
Roy the Third. Okay. Yes. May it please the court, Judge Kaur erroneously admitted 5 emails, and the reason they were erroneously admitted is they were not authenticated. In other words, we don't know who the emails came from, and the witness through whom the emails were admitted, Melvin Norwood, acknowledged he didn't know who they came from, and the government contends they came from a man named Haywood Borders, but Mr. Norwood didn't know Mr. Borders, and there's no evidence he'd ever communicated with him. So we have these 5 emails admitted without any proof whatever as to who they were from. And this is error, and it's prejudicial error, because these emails were used by the government to tie the Norwood property transaction to the main fraud scheme. And by tying the Norwood property transaction to the main fraud scheme, they tied Roy III to the main fraud scheme. Roy III acknowledged being involved in the Norwood transaction, but said that was a private deal between him and the Norwoods, not part of any larger fraud scheme. So these were important statements that were not authenticated and therefore shouldn't have been admitted. And in addition to being prejudicial, they're not harmless error for the very same reason that they are important statements. Remember, Roy III was acquitted of 6 of 11 counts, and all the counts he was convicted of were the real estate counts. So tying him for a real estate transaction to the main fraud scheme is both highly prejudicial and cannot be harmless error. So we would ask the court to reverse and remand for a trial without this prejudicial and erroneously admitted evidence.
Thank you. And for Roy Jr., Brandstrater, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Brandstrater. I represent Roy Fluker, Jr., the father in this case. Mr. Fluker challenges the admissions of the consent decree and his prior convictions into the record in this trial. While we acknowledge judicial admissions may fall out of the stricture of the balance test, we're asking this court to ask why. A judicial admission is a plea of guilty. A plea of guilty is a judicial admission. A plea of guilty, when sought to be admitted into a criminal trial, requires that the court look at it to determine prejudicial impact versus probative value. We do not argue that the consent decree in this case would not be relevant. It's based on the same set of facts. But we do argue it's completely, utterly, entirely prejudicial to a fair trial to Roy Fluker on the indictment that he was charged with. Because it leads the jury to believe, why do we have to pay any attention to the evidence coming in? This guy's already admitted this in another forum. Why pay attention? He's already said he did it. The evidence is so overwhelming, why do they need it? There are various reasons, as this court, and I actually don't because I don't do civil law, but I understand there are various reasons why some might admit, agree, negotiate, compromise in a consent decree in a civil case to get rid of the case. The defendant can't afford to litigate the case. There are an umbrella of reasons, but one might just want to push the Illinois Securities Act complaint off the table and have him focus on the criminal case. The problem we have in this case, there was no balancing test at all. The defendant filed a motion to preclude it. The trial judge denied that motion. Never spoke to the fact, well, yeah, we understand this is pretty prejudicial, but it's also really relevant because it's the same case. I'm going to let it in. Or give the defendant a chance to say, I only entered this consent decree because I couldn't afford to litigate it. So I think it's unfair to now allow it in the, in the felony case against me. To the same extent, the admission of the prior convictions hits the same roadblock. There was no balance of dust. They are prior crimes of moral turpitude, where I think it makes it really important for the judge to say, we have to determine how prejudicial this might be, versus how relevant, how necessary is it? What's your quantity and quality of evidence that you even need this? The government makes issue of the fact that Mr. Fluker, after the court denied his motion to preclude the admissions of his prior convictions, sort of complied. Well, what's a trial lawyer to do? He lost. He lost his first battle. The convictions are coming in. Many good, fine trial lawyers fronts it to the jury. Let them hear it from me and not from them. We'll tell you what our problems is, but only because, in the back of his mind, the judge has already ruled against me. And there was a long discussion about a limiting instruction on the consent decree. However, the instruction was only considered against Roy Fluker Jr., nobody else. Not why you should consider it, or how you should consider it, or on what basis you should consider it.
Interesting,
or
you said
consider it as substantive evidence only against. I'm sorry.
It's interesting, you said they didn't need it. You mean the evidence was overwhelming? So that
if that's the government's position, the evidence is overwhelming.
No, why you said they didn't. You said they didn't need it. I want to know, why didn't they need it from your point of view?
Candidly, my argument would be that after my client testified, and I can't go into why or where or how, his position seemed pretty delicate as compared to the indictment.
Okay.
Let me say that his initial plans to invest and prosper and lend back to the community, as I read the transcript candidly, an investment in a house in Harvey didn't quite meet that guideline. But nevertheless, Judge, when we go back, particularly the consent decree.
I'm interested in your argument for the purity of the law, but I wanted to know what that meant. You know, that they don't need it. Why did you plead guilty?
I can't answer that question, Judge. I was not trial judge. I trial court. We simply believe that a judicial admission should meet the same strictures as the relevant evidence, that all relevant evidence must meet. Is it too prejudicial? Is the probative relevant value such to overcome that prejudice? Thank you.
Thank you. For the government, Mr. Hines.
Yes, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This Court should affirm the convictions and the sentences of each of the three defendants who together carried out a massive fraudulent scheme that victimized thousands of people who trusted them with millions of dollars, and in the case of a couple dozen people who also trusted the defendants with their homes. I'd like to address the issues that have been raised in the order that they've been raised, unless you'd prefer otherwise. The first argument that was made on behalf of Ron Anita Fluker dealt with the use of the ostrich instruction. And, of course, the standard of review for that is whether the court abused its discretion in giving that instruction. The evidence at trial showed that Ron Anita deliberately avoided confirming details regarding the fraudulent scheme. She clearly knew that she and her father and her brother were promoting a program promising people an incredible return on their invested capital, as Judge Kaur said, and as Your Honor recognized. You know, 25% a month for a year. And that's in addition to the huge expenses that MTE was incurring, for both just the regular operation of the business as well as various extravagant things such as giving all the board members cars, buying them clothes, providing luxury trips to Hawaii and the Caribbean. Thus, the evidence really shows that Ron Anita did have reason to know that the scheme was fraudulent. At the very least, the evidence showed that she had good reason to doubt its legitimacy. And as Judge Kaur noted, you know, the defendant's promises were not objectively possible. These things just couldn't work. And those facts alone warrant the giving of the ostrich instruction.
Well, I ask you the same question. Were there certain counts where it was kind of shaky and the deliberate avoidance was basically what those counts were based upon?
Yeah. Judge, I don't think there was any distinction between those counts and the other counts that
I'm hooked on three of them. I just was curious if there were.
Right. No, I don't think the Astridge instruction had anything to do with the
targeting certain
the few counts that she
as
was
opposed to others. Okay.
Acquitted on. Exactly. I think it was more a matter of the strength of the witnesses, frankly, who testified. Some of them were older persons, and their memories weren't as good, perhaps, on certain points. But it really is not a matter of a distinction between the Astridge instruction applying to certain counts and not to other counts. That didn't, in my view, and I was at the trial, it did not play a part in that distinction.
Well, I'm having some trouble getting a handle on what she deliberately avoided. Did the bank statements come to her and she refused to open them, or
Judge,
how did she go out of her way not to get certain information?
Judge, the evidence was clear at trial, including not only through the testimony of various persons who worked with her, but through the testimony of her own father who took the stand, that he had nothing to do with computers. She was the computer person at MTE. And she often transferred money from one account to another. She made all the mortgage payments for the persons who were victimized by the housing program, who turned over most of the equity in their homes to MTE. It was, as her own father stated, it was her job to do these electronic bank transfers. She had access. It's certainly a fair inference based on all that evidence that she is the one who had access to the bank account information. If there were any investments being made, she would have seen that with her access to the bank account information. She could see for herself, if she chose to do so, what, if any, investments were being made and what returns, if any, were being earned. And there simply, as you know, were not any investments made or earned. The bank statements would have shown that if there had been. Another factor justifying the use of the Astridge instruction that this court has recognized in multiple cases is the defendant's knowledge of others' involvement in illegal or suspicious activities. The court has consistently found that that's significant in giving an Astridge instruction. And in this case, the evidence was abundantly clear that the housing program was thoroughly corrupt. I mean, not only was the spend and redeem on its face completely unreasonable and unbelievable, but the housing program was permeated with all sorts of false acts, false documents. Within it, they had what they called the A-buyer program, which was essentially a nice way to refer to a straw purchaser arrangement, where they would have one person who was a member of MTE who had good credit set up as the straw purchaser of a home of another person who was in MTE who didn't have as good a credit rating. That would then include making false representations to the lender as to whether the A buyer would be living in the residence as his or her primary residence. In many cases that Ron Anito was involved in and actually directing other employees at the company, phony leases and other documents, other false documents, were created to enable these loans to go through. For both the A buyers as well as other participants in the housing program, MTE money was often deposited into persons' bank accounts to make it appear that they had more assets than they really did, again, in order to make the loans go through. And it was Ron Anita who was the one, again, handling the money, doing the electronic transfers.
Obviously went after people who had a good deal of equity in their house.
That's correct.
And somehow or other they were able to suck out the money based on that equity. Ostensibly they say, well, we're going to pay your mortgage and everything.
Right.
But how did they get that money?
The three defendants throughout this scheme induced, as I said, about two dozen people to participate in this. And basically their pitch was, you haven't paid off your house completely. if you refinance your home and turn over to us either the majority of the equity or all of the equity, we will take over the payments for the house. You won't have to make any mortgage payments. Or you'll have to make lesser payments. And we'll pay off the house not in 30 years, but in 5 years. And many of the victims testified at trial, and they said they found that very attractive. And they had been induced to participate in this largely because they trusted the defendants who had started them with the spend and redeem program and had been paying them off, as in any typical Ponzi scheme, with the earlier investors' money. But they had gotten the money, so even though this may have sounded too good to be true, it seemed to be true. It was actually working out as far as the victims could tell. But as I said, there were a number of false, illegal, suspicious activities that Ron and Nita was either a party of or was certainly privy to. Another one was that she was the person who made all the mortgage payments. And as we were just discussing, the people who entered the housing program were promised that their mortgages would be paid off in 5 years. In fact, they were given at a second closing following the refinancing of their homes a document called a loan calculator, which was created on Ron Anita's computer, which was basically an amortization schedule, which showed 60 equal payments, which would pay off over a five-year period of time the entire mortgage that they were getting. But in fact, Ron Anita was the one, again, the person who handled the bank account and the transfers of money. She was the one who made all the mortgage payments. And although throughout the period of this scheme, the people were being told, we'll pay off your mortgage in 5 years, Ron Anita made payments, simply minimal payments, that were sufficient to pay off the mortgage in 30 years. She knew that there were no larger payments being made consistent with this loan calculator that the people were being given. Instead, they were given, they were making just the minimal payments that would pay off the mortgage in 30 years. Notwithstanding that, she continued to make false representations to later victims. Even as the scheme was about to collapse in the fall of 2006, Ron Anita Fluker was directly involved in dealing with a woman named Virginia Edwards, who was in the hospital, and actually went to the hospital to get her to finish signing the documents and to get the access to her home. And she knew at that time that, for many, many months, she had not been making the promised payments that MTE said that they would be. And yet again, at that point, she was still making those false statements to her. In general, Your Honors, the evidence at trial supported a finding of both actual knowledge and deliberate avoidance on the part of Ron Anita. And the government may, in fact, offer evidence relevant to both actual knowledge and a deliberate ignorance theory. There's nothing wrong with that. In addition to that, there were other jury instructions which eliminated any possible harm from the ostrich instruction. The district court, in addition to that instruction, also gave a good faith instruction. And it also instructed the jury that if a defendant performed acts that advanced the criminal activity but had no knowledge that a crime was being committed or was about to be committed, those acts alone are not sufficient to establish the defendant's guilt. So in light of all the evidence in the case, including the substantial evidence that she had actual knowledge of these illegal activities, as well as in light of these other jury instructions that were given, any possible error from the use of the ostrich instruction in this case was harmless. Moving on to the argument made concerning the emails relating to the Norwoods. And an MTE employee or board member named Haywood Borders. These emails were, in fact, relevant, and they were properly authenticated. I mean, as an initial matter, the burden for proof of authentication is a very slight one. And there were a number of facts in this case that did authenticate them. The facts that the emails were sent to members of MTE, Mr. and Mrs. Norwood, on an account that previously had been used by the Norwoods to communicate with Roy III at MTE. And these emails, when you look at the contents of the emails, contain particular details concerning the Norwoods' dealings with MTE and with Roy III in particular. All those things taken together were sufficient to establish circumstantially that these emails actually were sent by an agent of MTE. Moreover, these were not hearsay. They were not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. In fact, these emails contained a number of lies that were sent by Hayward Borders on behalf of MTE to placate the Norwoods, who for a long time no mortgage payments were being made on their behalf, and they were getting in trouble with their mortgage company. The emails, among other things, asserted that the banks were going to release the MTE's frozen assets in January of 2008. They asserted that MTE would provide the Norwoods with a lump sum payment of over $108,000 or $9,000 per month plus interest. They also contained representations that a certain property in Michigan that had been purchased in the Norwoods' name through the A-Buyer program had about $50,000 in equity, which would be applied towards the mortgage on the Norwoods' home that they refinanced through Roy III. All those statements were false. These were not being, these emails were not being offered to prove the truth of those assertions. The relevance of those actually was in the fact that an individual sending emails from an MTE email address was acknowledging that the Norwoods' mortgage difficulties were in fact the responsibility of MTE. As counsel said, Roy Fluker III tried to assert that this was a separate scheme. This wasn't part of the MTE scheme. And actually, there's a considerable about other evidence that showed that this was not the case. The Norwoods learned about this from Roy III when he made a presentation about the housing program at an MTE meeting. He actually presented to the Norwoods documents for them to sign in the name of Locust International, which was one of the businesses that MTE used in the course of the housing program. One of the documents actually had MTE itself on it. But notwithstanding all that, the defense at trial tried to make the point that Roy III was off on his own lark, frolic and detour, and that this was a separate fraudulent scheme, and it wasn't part of that. But in fact, these emails showed that MTE was in fact continuing to acknowledge responsibility for the losses that the Norwoods were incurring. And again, in light of all of the evidence that I've just described, any admission, any error possibly from the admission of that evidence was harmless. Finally, I'd like to just address quickly the two arguments raised on behalf of Roy Fluker Jr. There was no abuse of discretion at all in admitting the evidence of the consent order that he had signed with the Illinois Secretary of State Securities Department. That consent order was comprised of a number of relevant direct admissions by Roy Jr. concerning the charged conduct in this case, and it was highly probative, and it was not unfairly prejudicial. Unfortunately for defendants, highly probative, relevant evidence is prejudicial, but it doesn't mean it should be excluded. It was not unfairly prejudicial. It didn't give him much room to wiggle with, but it was admissible. And in fact, this case is really indistinguishable from this court's case in 1995, United States versus Donald Austin, in which Mr. Austin had made various factual admissions in a civil proceeding with the FTC before being prosecuted criminally in this courtroom, or in this courthouse, and this court held that those admissions that he had made to the FTC were in fact admissible in his subsequent criminal trial. I mean, essentially, this is like a civil plea agreement, but the fact is Roy Jr. admitted to various findings of facts, admitting to fraudulent conduct in the course of this scheme. And it's really no different from a confession that's made to a law enforcement agent, which is certainly admissible, notwithstanding the fact that it's very damning. And there wasn't any prejudice to Roy III either, given the limiting instructions that the court gave both at the time that the evidence was introduced as well as at the during the final charge to the jury. Finally, there was certainly no abuse.
That's the fourth time you said finally, which is...
I'm sorry, Judge.
I say that's the fourth time you've said finally, but I'm keeping your score.
I'm not a very good job. I'm doing a good job of keeping a track of finality, I guess. The final issue that I would like to address, unless you have questions about any others, is the admission of the evidence of Roy Jr.'s prior felony convictions. The fact is he waived the right to object on appeal to the admission of these convictions by himself preemptively introducing the evidence of those convictions during his direct examination. He introduced that evidence before the government did, and notwithstanding the fact that the court had ruled, actually not about both of his convictions, but contrary to what was argued before, but the court had ruled previously that one of the two admissions, or one of the two convictions could be admitted. Notwithstanding that, the Supreme Court has said that the defendant's introduction of that evidence precludes appellate review. That issue's waived, essentially. And even if it weren't, I mean, waived, the fact is, once he did raise it during his direct examination, the government was certainly entitled to probe further. And in fact, the government didn't ask many questions about it. The government did limit its questions primarily to clarify the nature of one of the two convictions that he acknowledged on direct examination, which he described simply as uttering and publishing, a phrase which doesn't really mean much to the average layman. And the government asked a couple questions to establish that that really, you know, was a technical term relating to his forgery of a false instrument in the past. And again, in the context of all the other evidence in this case, the evidence of those convictions was not prejudicial to him either. If you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer those. Otherwise, in conclusion, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the convictions and the sentences of each of the defendants in this case.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fisk, I don't know if you have any time left, but I'm going to give you 1 minute.
I appreciate that time, and thank you, Your Honor. If I may just briefly address the sentencing issues that I did not have the opportunity to previously. There are two aspects about Ms. Fluker's sentencing, two general aspects that, from my view, require remand for the purpose of resentencing. The first is something that developed during the pendency of this appeal, which is that because Ms. Fluker was convicted first and her co-defendants were convicted later, the calculation of loss amounts attributable to each defendant is different. The loss amounts attributable to Roy Jr. and to Roy III have been entered at approximately $7.3 million, which is $3 million lower than the initial loss amount attributed to Ronanita. That is because of, I believe, subsequent remuneration that was made out of a fund created to refund monies lost by certain defendants. As such, there's no logical basis or reason why the loss amounts should differ. I think that is only a product of the timing of the specific convictions. But I do think that it, remand for resentencing is warranted, if only to correct that loss amount.
But that doesn't affect her guidelines score, does it?
I don't believe that it would necessarily reflect her guideline score. Of course, there was a departure from her guidelines, and it would be hard to say if that would have had any impact, but the strict calculation of the guidelines themselves I don't think would be impacted. With that said, I would just stand on my other comments about sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beal.
4 minutes, Judge.
4 minutes. You don't have to use it all?
None of it. Use it all. Very, very briefly, Judge. On the email issue, I want to be clear. There was no evidence the emails are actually from the man named Haywood Borders. It's conceivable that they could have been from someone connected somehow with MTE, But that puts Roy III in a position of how does he refute or contest emails from somebody he doesn't know who they are. And it could have been someone who was trying to hone in on or get a piece of his private deal with the Norwoods. So they remain unauthenticated, and the admission of the unauthenticated emails were prejudicial to him.
Thank you. How much time does he have left?
1 minute.
1 minute, if you want.
Your Honor, the government makes analogy to a confession in a criminal trial as to the consent decree. Obviously, a confession in a criminal trial is prejudicial, but also, obviously, it comes into a felony trial under its own set of safeguards. It's got to be voluntary, no issues of coercion or that. We don't have that with the consent decree.
Wasn't he counseled in the state proceeding? Didn't he have counsel?
I'm sorry.
Didn't he have an attorney in the state proceeding?
He did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Thanks to all counsel. And if I am observing correctly, Mr. Fisk and Mr. Beal, you were both appointed?
Yes.
Mr. Grandstrader, you were not? All right. Well, thank you to all counsel, especially to appointed counsel and your firms for undertaking this task and representing your clients to the best of your abilities. That will take the case under advisement.